It's your friendly stranger, John Cannell, here once again with yet another informative and stimulating interview. Our special guest for today is Greg Felton. Mr. Felton holds a bachelor's degree in Russian studies and a master's in political science from the University of British Columbia. He is an investigative reporter and a columnist on politics in the media, with his international columns on the Middle East appearing in the Canadian Arab News, MediaMonitors.net, The Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, Akram, and Al Jazeera. He has created some deal of interest with his soon-to-be-published book titled Enemies by Design, Inventing the War on Terrorism. It's an in-depth illustrative work exposing special interest groups who cultivate, then promote, negative depictions of the Muslim world to justify otherwise unjust aggressions against the innocent peoples of Afghanistan, Iraq, and Palestine. So, without further delay, it's my pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Greg Felton. Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. John, yourself?
I'm doing okay. I'm a little uneasy with the studio here. I usually have an assistant with me, and today I'm by myself, so hopefully everything will go okay. But yeah, it's a fascinating subject that you're bringing to our attention with your new book. And one of the interesting, it's almost shocking to some, I'm sure, but part of what you've addressed in your book is that there's actually no evidence substantiated that truly links Muslims to the attack of 9/11. And I was hoping you might elaborate a bit more on that.
Well, for example, one of the best pieces of evidence we're told is that the planes from Boston's Logan Airport was hijacked and flown into Tower 1.
Mm-hmm.
However, no equipment at the Boston Airport shows any Muslims getting on the aircraft. No Muslim names appear on the passenger list. And we're supposed to believe that Muhammad Atta and other people bought their tickets with their own credit cards.
Mm.
And there seems to be a lot of unanswered questions and contradictory information, such that one is reasonably allowed to believe that what we are told is not true. And in fact, the entire September the 11th attack was so elaborate and so well coordinated that it is probably beyond the capabilities of any so-called Muslim terrorist groups. This was a very organized, very sophisticated operation, and it is hard to believe that Muslims with a few razor knives got on board aircraft and flew them into these buildings. It's not credible. And in fact, the Pentagon plane, the American Airlines Flight 11, that simply wasn't possible. That did not happen.
What was it in particular regarding Flight 11 that was?
Well, that particular one was there was no wreckage. There were materials in front of the building, such as fiber cable spools, that were utterly undamaged. Neighboring parts of the air building neck adjacent to the impact site were undamaged. In fact, the entire face of the Pentagon that was hit is inconsistent with the impact of a Boeing 757 or a 767. Hmm. It is, however, consistent with that of a cruise missile, which would leave such a very narrow, deep hole within the Pentagon.
Hmm.
No, I don't want to get too deeply into this.
Yeah, well, I know.
It's all part of the book. But, in fact, nobody has adduced any evidence that a Muslim was responsible for this attack. It's everything that we know about this comes from sources that have a vested interest in making Muslims look as horrible as possible. And this is the basic reason why I'm writing this book, is to debunk a lot of the negative stereotyping that has infected our minds and has turned us against Muslims.
Right. Well, as it was so reported by MSNBC's Jim Mikliszewski, yes, right, sorry. That's right, Mikliszewski. I mean, he told us that he has these presidential directive documents outlining a strategy to invade Afghanistan specifically, and they're dated September 9th, 2001. So I can see what you're saying. They want to demonize Afghanistan to some degree anyway as a part of a strategy that existed prior to 9/11. They're already set up to do what you're saying.
And also, if you look at the behavior of the United States government after the arrival of George W. Bush, Bush essentially dropped any attempt by the previous administration to capture bin Laden. In fact, the United States went out of its way to play footsie with the Taliban to coerce, cajole, wheedle, and bribe them into allowing trans-Afghanistani pipeline access.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the time, let's not forget that the United States wanted to put a pipeline from Turkmenistan across Afghanistan into Pakistan and from there to the Indian Ocean.
Right, right.
Because they wanted to tap the great Jalal-Tabad oil field,
mm-hmm.
just next to Uzbekistan. Unfortunately, the Taliban had a prior deal with Bright Ass of Argentina, and they would not go back on that deal.
Right.
The United States wouldn't take no for an answer, so they put tremendous pressure on them, and there was a meeting in Berlin in August of 2001 where they said, essentially, you will either allow us to put our pipeline across, or we'll bomb you.
Yeah, and I think it was a minister anyway from Pakistan who had quoted one of the people at that meeting who said that the threat was that they would carpet bomb their country.
Yeah, a carpet of gold or a carpet of bomb.
Oh, that was it. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So they were friends with the Taliban, tried to cozy up to them, giving them even cash, too. I think there was like $43 million they'd given to them. They actually congratulated them for eradicating the heroin trade, and that was one of the reasons why that money was given to them, and so it was said. And then soon as they lost an opportunity to cajole them into accepting a contract from Enron is one of the members of that consortium. As soon as the Taliban said, we're not going to take your offer, that's when they turned the wheels against them, right? They gave this threat, and then, like I say, and you're aware, too, I mean, MSNBC has reported that they put together a strategy to invade Afghanistan. And, boy, what a pretext 9/11 turned out to be for them. I guess they would have us think that that was all just a coincidence, I suppose.
What's really interesting is that Rumsfeld, soon after the attack on Afghanistan, at least the attack on September the 11th, had no intention or no desire to go into Afghanistan because there were no useful targets.
Yeah.
He wanted to bomb Iraq.
Right.
And that really is much of the book, as to why they wanted to bomb Iraq within minutes, within hours
mm-hmm.
of September the 11th attacks. Now, why would they want to bomb Iraq, which at that time had no link at all to the event?
Mm-hmm. Well, and part of Rumsfeld's request, as it was reported, was he said, find anything and all things, anything to connect to Iraq, anything. Like, he's a little bit more familiar with the nature of truth mm-hmm. and deception, and that you just reach out and try to find something that we can connect Saddam to this terrorist act. And I think I know why. One of the reasons is their strategy was to use no evidence in allegations against bin Laden. It's phenomenally interesting from my perspective, and I'm sure a lot of other people would be interested also to learn that their strategy is to not use any evidence as a guaranteed prerequisite to, as you say, gain access into Afghanistan. Whether bin Laden did it or not, I mean, if they use no evidence, bin Laden will plead not guilty. The Taliban will support his defense because they're fundamentalists. They don't want to prosecute the innocent.
But there's one thing to remember, though, is
okay.
that the attack on Afghanistan, however, is not part of the war on terrorism. Because that was in play long before September the 11th had happened. What happened after that, the bombing of Afghanistan, was essentially a religious, visceral hatred of Muslims. That was, we're going to go bomb you because we got to take our anger out on somebody.
Mm, yeah, there's that for sure.
And the war on terrorism, so-called, this horrible expression that was actually Ronald Reagan cooked up just after the Iran hostage crisis. But the war on terrorism, so-called, refers to the bombing of Iraq and the general repression of Muslims around the world, even in the United States itself.
Mm-hmm.
Afghanistan must be separated from these. There is a connection. There is sort of a peripheral one, but it's not really central to the argument. And this is something my book does point out very clearly. Because people who look at Iraq and say, oh, well, they're in there for the oil fields. They're in there to get control of the oil. There is a connection in their minds between what happened in Afghanistan and what went on in Iraq, but there is no connection there. These are two entirely separate events brought about by the same people, but with different objectives.
Mm-hmm. Well, in both objectives, so they, like the thing about people talking about gaining strategic control of the oil, well, that might be part of it, but I mean, all the billions and billions and billions of dollars we've watched move have gone through the criminal enterprise itself. I mean, it's all these, it's the looting of the Iraq development funds, like all the money that was in the possession of the Iraqi government, Bush just claimed sole ownership of, and that's all called theft in my world and in everybody else's, but people just aren't so familiar, they don't really, you know, that's his opinion. Well, no, how do you figure Bush earned his right to take possession of all Iraqi assets, not only the oil, but everything else?
And, but again, you're making an economic argument. The
right.
whole point of getting into Iraq was economic.
Right.
But there's evidence to suggest that that is not true. It is categorically irrational for the United States to bomb Iraq into oblivion, torture and hideously, cruelly treat the Iraqi people,
mm-hmm.
lie and completely destroy their international reputation, send their own soldiers to die meaningless deaths in the desert. I mean, there is not one good thing that has come out of this for the United States. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted oil that badly, they would have found some way to do a deal with Saddam Hussein. Let's face it, the United States has done deals with worse people than Hussein.
Yeah, but
Pinochet, Suharto, Noriega, Marcos. What made Saddam Hussein so particularly heinous? Well, nothing particularly.
Well, he was moving his market into the euro. That's one thing. But it's also...
But so is Russia.
Yeah. But it's also important to recognize, too, like Halliburton can't take the billions and billions of dollars they have taken so far unless they indiscriminately murder the people there. Like, I mean, that's the thing. With the inspectors, they had complete access. But if they just let the inspectors do their job, you know, all the military-industrial complex isn't going to be able to take all that cash. So they make money off the chaos. So that's why you get Cheney so supportive of the war now. It's like, yeah, his buddies there are cashing, and, you know, they'll meet him for dinner or whatever, you know.
Yeah, but don't
let's
forget,
let's not be naive.
Yeah, but in 1991, Cheney said that no government that the United States imposed on Iraq would be recognized. It would create fissions and civil war between the Sunnis and the Shia. He actually had nothing good to say about it at all. I mean, essentially what Cheney predicted in 1991... the consequences he foresaw of invasion, bombing, and total subjugation of Iraq have borne fruit. He was absolutely accurate as the defense secretary. As a vice president, he has come full circle and lied through his teeth time and again to justify the indefensible. Now, we cannot look to an economic motive for this, because the economic motives and the consequences of brutality were well known. We have to look for some other reason. And that other reason has to do with Israel. And this is one of the main thesis of my book, is that the United States has committed acts of unspeakable brutality in Iraq, not because they want the oil, not because they want to pillage the country down to its last oil well, although that is part of it, but principally because Israel wanted to destroy the center of Arab learning and the great public supporter of the Palestinians. Saddam Hussein was almost unique among Persian Gulf leaders in that he was not afraid to take on Israel, if rhetorically, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. But I just want to get back to what you were saying about Israel. They too can earn money off of creating instability by them victimizing the innocent. Brings about another reason for Ariel Sharon to ask for more financial assistance from the American people.
But don't forget, Israel does know that it's pushing its luck. It knows that it has really lost the war for propaganda. It only exists because of its Maginot line of subservient media outlets that are doing its best to prop up the crumbling dike that's holding back the water of world indignation.
Yeah, and Jewish indignation too. It's
exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, like
some of the greatest victims of the Zionists.
I'm totally in agreement with you on that. That's for certain. Yeah, I feel that Ariel Sharon isn't even Jewish. I've argued that he isn't Jewish.
Well,
how do you figure he's Jewish?
His parents were Polish, and they came. And he was actually born it was Bethlehem or Jerusalem, but he was actually born there. But his parents are Polish.
Hmm.
I mean, he's a Slav. He's not even Middle Eastern.
Hmm. Yeah, and
this was with all the Ashkenazi. I mean, they're not. I mean, their role in informing Israel had nothing to do with religion. It was purely political.
Right, but
secular Jews, and they actually can look down and treated with contempt the common Yiddisher Jews, the believing Jews who wanted to live in Europe and become good members of European society. Mm-hmm. Because the Bible says that, you know, wherever Jews are, they should obey the laws of the land and treat everybody with justice.
Right, and that's why he wouldn't be found to be an honest Jewish person, because you have all people are created in God's image, and you don't want to do something to someone else that you wouldn't want to be done to yourself. I mean, you're victimizing who again? An innocent person. You say they haven't committed any criminal offense, but just because they're Christians, let's say, they're Christian Palestinians, you have some right by might, by American firepower, actually, to steal this person's home and essentially throw them into a concentration camp. You know, and some of these places are very much reminiscent.
Of course they are.
And I think that truth is very difficult for some people to deal with. Like, all people have problems with identity. Like, we, you know, not it's not only a Jewish thing. This is part of what all young adults go through, I suppose.
This is why the Holocaust is such a very dangerous thing to talk about, because it's not really understood. It's preached at us like a sermon. We're supposed to accept at face value what we're told about it, as if to criticize it is somehow disrespectful.
Yeah.
And much of what we know about the Holocaust has been propagated by the Zionists and can be shown to be quite untrue. I don't want to get into a long, detailed argument about this. It's not the purpose of this interview.
Well, the thing is we do one thing about the whole situation is that innocent people were targeted for murder. End of story. I mean, that's what the war was. I mean, all wars are like that. So it's hard to...
As a matter of fact, Lord Yehudi Menuhin, the famed violinist, told Le Figaro that he saw a direct parallel between Israel and Nazi Germany. And Jews will come out and they will make the connection between Nazi Germany and Israel. As a matter of fact, the Zionists who built Israel were Nazi collaborators. This goes back particularly to Yitzhak Shamir, who wanted to form an alliance with Hitler against the British. So the people who formed Israel were not really interested in forming a Jewish state. They were interested in forming an expansionist imperial state, that they were going to recreate the historic biblical kingdom of Israel. But religion was really not the driving force, because Ben-Gurion was a secular Jew, so was Chaim Weizmann. I mean, as I said, the religious believing Jews who wanted to live according to traditional Mosaic law and so forth and live in Europe peaceably, they were not welcome, and they were shunned. They were marginalized. And this is one of the few things that people don't understand about Israel. It is not a Jewish state. It never has been. It is a ethnocentric garrison state that adheres to the same master race mentality as did Hitler's Nazi Germany. And when you look at Iraq and the brutality and the kind of brutality that America is inflicting on the Iraqis, you see a direct parallel to the kind of brutality that the Israelis inflict on the Palestinians.
And Hitler inflicted on our world.
On the Jews, that's right. Yeah. And this is why you have to look beyond the economic argument, which, however relevant it may be, is not the prime reason why America bombed Iraq. It had no reason to. I'd like to read you one little thing I have for my book. This is Dick Cheney. And this is... what he said about the problem of getting rid of Saddam Hussein and the problem of putting another government in place. He said, what kind of government? Should it be a Sunni government or a Shi'i government or a Kurdish government or a Ba'athist regime? Or maybe we want to bring in some of the Islamic fundamentalists. How long would we have to stay in Baghdad to keep that government in place? What would happen to the government once U.S. forces withdrew? How many casualties should the United States accept in that effort to try to create clarity and stability in a situation that is inherently unstable? I think it is vitally important for a president to know when to use military force. I think it is also very important for him to know when not to commit U.S. military force. And it is my view that the president got it right both times. That would have been a mistake for us to get bogged down in the quagmire inside Iraq. Now, can you think of a more brilliant testament to the stupidity of George W. Bush?
Well, and it is stupid, and I think Now that you're saying that, I'm thinking they could be running from 9/11. You know, they'll do anything and everything to try to create fear within our societies to somehow stop true justice from prevailing in arresting, like, let's say, General Ahmad. You know, he's a they are creating a lot of fear.
Well, that fear is necessary for two reasons, and the principal reason for fear has nothing to do with Iraq. It has to do with the government itself. The Bush government is criminal.
Right.
There should
That's
be a Nuremberg trial set up to try everybody from George Bush to Condoleezza Rice,
absolutely,
Rumsfeld, Fife, everybody.
Right.
Both of it.
Exactly.
Now, the problem is, how do you keep people from paying attention to this? You keep them focused on an external enemy. You keep them thinking about the great enemy within, the other. And so they foment this fascistic hatred of a definable group of people.
Yeah.
And so the war on terrorism, so-called, is not so much a way for the United States to protect itself against its enemies. It is a way for it to create enemies to justify the kind of repressive measures that would otherwise be intolerable during peacetime.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right.
And that's why these are enemies by design. Muslims are necessary for the United States because it fits into the quasi-religious, demented mindset of a country that needs to have an enemy to feed a military-industrial complex that is so out of control it might as well be a rival country. The very thing that Dwight Eisenhower warned against in his farewell address in 1960, just before Jack Kennedy took office, or before Jack Kennedy was elected. This was Dwight Eisenhower's great prescient assessment of the failure of the United States to understand the limitations of its power. We are in a position now where we have a great industrial complex designed to turn out military equipment, but we don't want that to overburden our economy, to make it disproportionately military. We have to be careful of the military-industrial complex pushing our economy onto a perpetual war footing. But without a perpetual war footing, you can't justify the Republican Party's existence. Because Ronald Reagan came to power in 1980 because of the neocon economists, and they're the ones that made it possible for the Christians, particularly the Jews, to get into government and to contort the American administrations into serving Israel. And if you look at what happened with Ronald Reagan's government and the people who were involved in the Arms for Hostages scandal, in the Contra scandal, these are the same people that would now crop up in George W. Bush's government.
Matter of fact, one last thing here.
It's interesting to note that Vice President Bush referred to these people, Paul Wolfowitz, Michael Ledeen, Richard Pearl, Frank Gaffney, and a whole bunch of other people, he referred to them as the crazies.
Yeah.
Because they were crazy.
Mm-hmm.
He kept them at bay. He wanted nothing to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
See, Bush was a moderate. His son is I don't know what he is, but he's not moderate.
No, he's lawless completely. You know, he's used no evidence to back up his allegations. But I just want to say, like, we've fallen into the trap ourselves, I think. You know, when we refer to Paul Wolfowitz and all these guys as Jews, we forget that that's not what a Jew is, and that's the thing.
These are the Zionist Jews.
Yeah, well, I mean, that can be difficult. I mean, even Zionism has a positive reflection within biblical texts and is not connotated to the neocon. See, neocon, I know right away who they are. Like, neocon, I know right away. From my perspective, it's not really a religious thing.
If you look at neocon economists, it's not based in rational analysis of economics.
Right, exactly. But that doesn't connotate that they're referring to some biblical text or some...
It doesn't matter, but you see, religion does not have to be ecclesiastical.
Okay.
The religious mindset can appeal...
Yeah, it's a faith.
Yeah. Well, it's a dogmatic belief system in which reason and logic play little or no role.
Right. Yes. And so, so it is through their power of influence and suggestion that would have other people join their mantle to say, we want a regressive tax system, like you're saying, with reason and understanding. There's a progressive tax system, or there's a regressive tax system, which a neocon will always advocate, which is an act of destruction. You're killing yourself. But people go, no, it's just your opinion. And those who say it's just my opinion are those who don't understand. You know, you're taking money from poor people and putting it all into the hands of the wealthy, and they're not doing anything for you, and the economy's being drained. I mean, you want to keep some levels of balance in where government is taking their money that they're going to in turn spend. And it becomes a difficult thing to communicate because it takes time. People got to work it out.
Also, what's pernicious about that is that to the uninformed, it sounds logical. I have a major chapter in my book that's a little heavy going, but it's necessary. It analyzes for lack of a better word, the illogic behind neocon economics and what it truly is. And I go back to Leo Strauss, who is the intellectual progenitor of neocon economics. And it was he who influenced, who taught, actually, Paul Wolfowitz. I think it was in Chicago. And it was Leo Strauss who gave a whole generation of economists a pseudo-intellectual foundation upon which they could build the most atrocious philosophies and theories, essentially an unenlightened selfishness by which they could justify lower taxes because, hey, who likes to pay taxes? Mm. But they don't argue that taxes are necessary to provide for public goods.
Right, police services.
It was Edmund Burke who said, government is a human contrivance to meet public wants. Because we need to have things done for us, whether it's medical care, defense, postal service, maintenance of this, that, or the other thing.
Right.
Governments do have a function. But in the United States, government is almost demonized because anything that interferes with the absolute right of the individual to do anything he wants is seen to be a virtual sin against God. And the radical individualism that permeates much of biblical America has an affinity for this kind of thinking. So right away, you had this common perspective between the neocons and the Christians. And you have people like Paul Weyrich, who really started the ball rolling for the theocratization of American politics. I mean, he was the one who founded the Heritage Foundation, the first real political think tank of began the 1970s. There had been others around, but this was a major one that started the think tank industry going full tilt. And it was the Heritage Foundation that put Ronald Reagan into office. 11 people from Heritage were put into his administration. I mean, he was not the president of the United States. He was a mouthpiece for Heritage, let's face it. Paul Weyrich and Jerry Falwell, all these people saw in the neocons the sort of selfishness and arrogance that they brought to religion. And all they needed... Elitism in its own way is not necessarily bad, because we're all elitist in some way. But in a governmental sense, and this is what Leo Strauss taught, the governments have an obligation to keep from the public things they don't want the public to know, to tell the public only what they want it to know, and to use religion instrumentally to keep the public in line.
Yeah, like a government of traitors is their official dogma. We want to screw people over and lie to them. And in fact, are you familiar with the recent revelations regarding Rumsfeld and his secret army?
Oh, yes.
You heard about, it's again this naked treason kind of thing, like we had with Bush and torture. He says, I'm totally against torture, but we have these presidential directive documents saying it's okay. And then you have the memo from Gonzalez says, the strategy is you're going to argue with us about the definition of torture. You're going to tell us you don't support it, but you're going to say it's okay behind closed doors. And now if we confront you publicly and pull your demon carcass into the light, you're going to say, you're going to argue with us about the definition. So now that we got Rumsfeld, he's got his own. He wants to get a private military going. But the thing about it is they don't want to be accountable to the people because they're going to be doing things illegal.
But this is precisely, this goes to the heart, because Leo Strauss believed that for a government to be accountable to the public and to formulate policies that serve the public was a betrayal of the very philosophical principles that made Western society great.
You've been listening to an interview with Greg Felton, author of Enemies by Design, Inventing the War on Terrorism. If you want to hear this full interview in its entirety, feel free to get yourself to the internet. Go to Google and put World Productions in quotes, and throw Indie Media in there and you'll be able to find it. Continue further with our discussions. Have a great day, people. Look forward, though, to another fantastic broadcast coming your way very shortly.